Making movies is really tough. To get it all done, you gotta know your stuff. First you write a script, then you raise some cash. Shoot the film, then you're done in a flash. So here's some things that you need to know. It's My First Feature.
Hello and welcome to My First Feature. I'm your host, Ethan Cushing. I'm a director and producer working in Los Angeles, and this is the podcast where each week I interview a new filmmaker about the experience of directing their first feature film. With me today is writer-director Evan Morgan. Evan has written and directed several award-winning short films, but in 2020, he premiered his first feature film, The Kid Detective. Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for doing this. This was one of those fun ones where it was just a cold call. I saw an LA Times, a review of your film, and I was like, I love that genre. I love Adam Brody. I'm just going to jump on IMDb Pro and find you. So thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah. My first question, Evan, I think is what I ask everybody, which is, how did you get into filmmaking? How did you kind of catch the bug? When did it all start for you?
Started pretty young. My interest really began with Jim Carrey. I was such a huge, huge Jim Carrey fan when I was about 12, 13. He grew up just outside of Toronto, which is where I'm from. And Ace Ventura was the first movie that I ever saw in theaters that felt meant that scene at the beginning of the movie where he's rewarded for like tracking down the dog and like she offers to take his pants off. I had no idea what that was, what that meant, what was going on. I just knew I shouldn't be seeing it. And that was sort of the seed that was kind of planted in my brain as far as just my preoccupation with movies. Dumb and Dumber, I still regard as like one of the great like films of the 90s, one of the great screenplays of the 90s. And
okay, I promise I'll let you keep talking.
Sure.
But that is literally my story, dude. Like, The Ace Ventura and Back to the Future are my two favorite films. I know it hasn't aged well, but like, I would put that VHS tape in the first day of summer vacation every summer for my entire childhood. That scene when he returns the dog, I think subconsciously that was part of my sexual awakening, even though I didn't know what was going on at the time. I can literally play that movie backwards and forwards. And I can definitely now see some of that influence in your work, but sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no, please. I'd love to hash on about this because that scene particularly, like it's the opening credits are closing and he puts his like arms, he grabs some kind of pole or something on the ceiling and just starts moving around. And I had absolutely no idea what the innuendo was, but, it was, yeah, I agree. It was an awakening for me as well. And, with Dumb and Dumber, returning to Ace Ventura and the sequel, I do it every few years and I'm always just delighted by what I find there. I agree they haven't aged as well as something like Dumb and Dumber, which I think is still just a note-perfect comedy. What I love about Ace Ventura is like if you compare it with like Austin Powers or any of the other kind of iconic 90s heroes from comedy, he's self-aware. He knows that he's being an idiot. He knows he's being an asshole and he just does it for kicks because he doesn't give a shit. And that I find just so incredible. And I can't even really think of, I'm sure there are other instances, maybe like, you know, old Chevy Chase characters like Fletch, but that's what makes Ace Ventura such a kind of like timeless icon for me. It was just that he knew what he was doing.
I think he does it. I mean, maybe this is a Jim Carrey thing. I think he does it in The Mask too, which is another one of my favorite sort of teenage building films. You know, he's like making all these jokes just because he thinks it's funny, you know, as The Mask, which anyways. Let's do a separate episode talking about Jim Carrey.
I'd love to,
movies.
Yeah.
Anyways, right. keep going.
So anyway, I remember getting extremely excited when they announced The Truman Show as being like his big first dramatic breakthrough. And the fact that the movie was so large in terms of its scale, that it was about something that was, you know, at the time considered sort of like very futuristic. And now we could consider clairvoyant when you see what's happened with like reality television and just people's preoccupation with social media and da, 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 da. But I got so excited for that as a kid. I remember just telling my family that we had to go on the first screening of the first Friday that it was released. And while we were sitting there, an hour into the movie, the projector broke. And,
oh, no.
They were trying to fix it and it was taking, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Then they came out and started offering people vouchers to come back and see it another time. And my family was like, okay, well, let's go. And I was like, no, we have to stay, because I knew that I was watching my favorite film of all time. And that was the moment that really my interest transitioned from, wanting to be the star of the show, like in front of the camera and, demonstrating like brash antics and da 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 da, to actually wanting to be a storyteller, because I was just so moved by the storytelling of that film and by just how purely cinematic it was. Like that moment where he stops traffic with his hands and like the Philip Glass score picks up. It's like, that still, I think, is like my favorite movie moment, except for maybe the ending of that film.
Oh my gosh, that gets you every time.
Yeah. And so that's where it began for me. I knew like at the age of 14 that I wanted to be a screenwriter and a director and started doing so at that age. The first feature film I ever wrote, I wrote when I was 15.
Wow.
And then the second one that I wrote was like 15 years after that.
Really? Oh, wow. Big gap.
Big gap. Not for lack of trying, but just because I was so, because I guess like I had, committed to that course so early, I started to feel a sense of pressure very early too, because all my friends knew that, you know, I was a screenwriter and a director and, you know, I was working on my masterpiece. And like, as a result, that kind of pressure sort of, you know, it got heavier and heavier, and I found it harder to actually complete shit. And that's one of the things that kind of, you know, resonates for me about The Kid Detective and that particular story, was just that sense of knowing who you are at such a young age that it actually becomes something you're beholden to.
That's really fascinating you say that. Again, this is a random aside, and sorry, it's about you, I promise. But I think I went to film school. You spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this education for this piece of paper that actually doesn't really matter when you get into the real world and filming. And then, you know, every once in a while, like, you have peaks and valleys, and sometimes in the valleys, I'm like, well, what if I just went off and, you know, design board games, or, you know, was a taxi driver or whatever. And I'm like, I'm an artist, right? Like, I'm a filmmaker, right? Like, and so like, if I put that away or put that in a box, and like, who am I? What do I become? Like, and do I have the strength to, make that decision, which is a valid decision. Like, you know, it's not who you are per se. Like, it's a facet of what you love to do. But that question, I think, weighs on me a lot. And I think that was a theme in the movie I did resonate with a lot with. Anyways, continue.
That's great. I think like, I would often wonder throughout my 20s as well, like, am I just doing this because I decided that this was who I am at 15? You know, maybe if things had taken a different course, maybe I would have found an occupation that was still creative, but maybe wasn't such a struggle, because making a movie, you know, there's the process of financing it, which is its own ordeal, but like, just motivating yourself and trusting yourself to be able to kind of forge your own career, you know, rather than go and interview for jobs. And, you know, it's a career that relies on your own self-discipline, and you're working in, you know, most of the time in isolation in your apartment. And you don't really, you're not interacting with your environment on a daily basis. You're interacting with yourself and with ideas that are getting older every single day that you wake up to a project. I found that to be really challenging when I was in my 20s, was just the isolation combined with this pressure that like, oh, I have to do this because I told everyone I was going to do it. And it has to be really great because I've been, you know, the film guy for so long, and I've been talking, you know, shit about all these movies since I was a teenager.
I could do better than them.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's certainly how, you know, really The Kid Detective as an idea, it started as a short film that I was flirting with, like potentially making when I was in film school, for a story about an actual kid detective who solves like grisly crimes in kind of a, you know, a sort of surreal, almost kind of like comic book-esque world where there's just lots of gnarly stuff happening at all times. And then it was after I met Adam and I was trying to think of ideas that would work for him that I saw the opportunity to just retool that concept. And actually, you know, that at that point it became really exciting. But one of the things that excited me about it wasn't just the central irony as far as the character and that concept. It was just the fact that I could relate to it so instantly in terms of, you know, just declaring, you know, when I was a teenager, look, I'm going to be a filmmaker, and, you know, I'm going to take a year off of school before I, you know, go to university to write a script, which is what I determined to do. And it's great to, I guess, to have that sense of direction. It can also be like a real burden, and it takes what is ideally a very natural process and a source of enjoyment. Like the first script that I wrote when I was 15, I wrote in one summer, and it was just easy. Like it just, there was nothing at stake. And I just enjoyed it. And I enjoyed, living in a fictional world and allowing a story to unfold in front of me. And it was cool. And there was, nothing like it, then right afterwards when it was done and I was like, look, guys, I'm a screenwriter now. That's when it stopped being fun.
Right. Totally. No, I think you hit on something very interesting and I think resonant, which is you're spending, God knows how many hours crafting a story that presumably you want to then make. I think we all have, tried to hit on stories or kernels of ideas that at the end of the day, however far you get into the script, you're like, this isn't for me. Like, I don't care enough about this to continue writing it. But like when you have something like what you're saying, we're like, hey, this is me, this is my story. And this is maybe the one thing that I'm so passionate about that hits so hard for me that like, it's that connection in and of itself is what's propelling you forward to continue to write it. And I think if you don't have that, or if you're trying to like back into like, oh, well, I'm going to sell a horror script because horror's hot or, whatever. I don't think that ever really pans out as well as what you did. But let me go back real quick. So you went to film school, you made a few short films. I saw one of them, which I highly recommend. If anyone can check it out online, it's called A Pretty Funny Story. And then you were working on the seat of this short. You said you met Adam. So the star of the film is Adam Brody, probably most known for The OC, which is one of my favorite films, shows. How did you connect with him and what was the process of you're like, oh, I'm going to write you a film.
Well, I, like you, was a really big fan of The OC, particularly the first season and particularly what Adam was doing on it. Cause I just thought he was so funny and, broke through the formula of that show in just such a surprising way. And it was something that I discovered a few years after it had aired, because originally I just didn't assume I would be interested. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw it, I was like, holy shit, this is not what I thought it was. This is so funny. And I cared so much for those characters. And, because of how I also identified with Adam's character, he, became sort of a special fictional character for me, where I knew that I wanted to work with him. I was at TIFF, I believe. It was the first time that we ran into each other. I was at TIFF with my first short film. And I approached him and was just like, look, I'm just like such a big fan. I think
that's cool.
Hilarious. And Adam is a super approachable guy as well. And, shared with him, some of my work and, basically said that we were going to be, emailing some ideas back and forth. And
wait, I got to stop you. Sorry.
Yeah.
You're making this sound like they're like, yeah, anybody can do this. But like, obviously your work has to speak for itself and your talent has to speak for itself. And obviously it did if you went to TIFF and you had some shorts. But I guess did you have was there a inner monologue or dialogue with yourself of like, oh man, this is like one of my heroes. This actor is so funny. I love this show. It resonates with me. And the sidebar, me too. I really think we're aligned in terms of our cultural touch.
Yeah,
stuff. But like, but I don't want to bother him. He's like, he's a celebrity, da, da, da. Or are we just like, no man, like I like this guy. I want to tell him what's going on. But then that we've all done that too. Like, I've stopped someone and been like, hey man, I'm so sorry to bother you. I just love your work. I wanted you to know that I'm a big fan, and then walk away. But then you turn that into like, and now I'm going to make a film for you, or like, or I want to show you my work. How do you make that transition? Or was it just a natural thing? Or,
I think it was really, it was about context. And me and, Matt Johnson, who I made The Dirties with, we were in the process of shooting that movie, and at TIFF every year we had a tradition with some of our other friends where we would just basically crash as many parties as possible just to fully take advantage of what was happening in our city. And, just for the sport of it more than anything else, not to really be like, career, minded individuals. It was just about like the, about generating stories for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, basically we gate crashed this, like, I think it was like a Weinstein company party, and Adam was there, and because it was one of like the bigger, events, it's like anyone else who's there, you just assume is supposed to be there. And you earn the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
I think that worked in our favor. And what ultimately happened was, we ran into Adam again when we were at Slam Dance with The Dirties. and he was there with another film at Sundance. And we'd gotten so preoccupied with making that movie that we like just the original sort of intro with Adam didn't really lead to anything. Like we just got very much into the world of making the Dirties. And then finally it was done. And then he just happened to be in the same spot again at another party. And we reconnected and I was just like, okay, look, like take a look at the Dirties. And by then I had my short A Pretty Funny Story and I sent them both of those. And it was just, you know, it was obvious to him as it had been obvious to me that like we have a very similar sense of humor and a very similar taste. And that's when we really started talking seriously about, okay, well, what kind of idea can we start to pitch? I had this idea for The Kid Detective and just started running with it and wrote the first act of the movie very quickly within a few weeks, I think, just because the character just, again, like I understood that character so instantly. And because the world around him was sort of, you know, implied by the premise of the movie and by the premise of the character, it just all flowed very, very fast. And I was really happy with what was coming out. And we shared that with him and he was really stoked about it. And then I had to decide what mystery I wanted the character to solve. And that's where I stalled. And it took me at least another year to complete the script. When I did, I got back in touch and I'm sure at that point he was like, whatever happened to Evan, like in that Kid Detective script. Cause I just totally disappeared into my, you know, into my bedroom again. And, you know, he had a chance to read it again. He connected with it and we just determined we were going to try and get it made. And, we spent about 5 years, 4 to 5 years just trying to get it financed. And then finally we shot it last fall.
Amazing. That's fascinating. So let's stop there for 1 second and let's, for the audience, level set. Can you give a brief elevator pitch of the kind of the plot of the film so we're all on the same page?
Absolutely. So The Kid Detective, it's not a children's film. it's about a former kid detective who is now in his early 30s and still solving the same kinds of trivial mysteries in the context of his small community. But nobody cares anymore. And he sort of embraced this cycle of, you know, self-pity and alcoholism and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. And then the actual story is about him solving his first murder case. And so it kind of exists between sort of the world of, you know, Encyclopedia Brown and the hard-boiled world of detective fiction like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and, you know, Chinatown, that type of thing.
Awesome. Great. Let's on that note, let's take a quick break for a second and listen to a clip from the trailer just so folks can kind of get a sense of the tone. So we'll do that now.
So what can I help you with?
Somebody murdered my boyfriend.
Seriously?
Pretty seriously. He was stabbed 17 times.
Is it possible he was involved in drugs?
No, he would never do drugs.
Gambling?
No, he would never gamble.
Demon worship?
No, he would never worship a demon.
Yeah, so that'll give you a sense of what the film is. I imagine that connecting with Adam and finding that you guys have shared interests and his interest just in your work and film in general also helped propel you to be like, well, I'm gonna take this seriously. I gotta better start writing, right? Like we all have ideas that we want to do and then life gets in the way or whatnot, but this sounded like a real opportunity. And you sounds like you really ran with it. And then listen, mysteries are hard, right? Like I can't imagine Rian Johnson writing Looper, you know, or something like that. We're like, so I'm sure that that was its own nut to crack for you, but, talk about briefly, and I hope you don't, I'm like, this is my stuff. I love nerding out about this. So like, talk about the process. So you had a script, you and Adam had connected 5 years. Like what was that process like of trying to get the film, I guess financed or someone to get interested in it?
It was, at first it was exciting because I was just so pleased to finally have it drafted. And what you were saying about mysteries, like that was the thing. Like I was never a mystery guy. Like it was never my genre. I was intimidated by the prospect of having to deliver because what excited me about the premise was the character and the world and the opportunity to tell a story that was both inherently comic and dramatic. Where it just, you know, like it was those things already and I could kind of, you know, explore both of those tones at once in terms of just like the comic potential and the dramatic potential. That's why I really got excited about the idea. The mystery was always the thing that I was like, ah, damn it. And I got to do a mystery. And I read a lot of, Raymond Chandler, and I read a lot of Encyclopedia Brown, and I watched a lot of Without a Trace or, Law and Order or whatever I could find just to kind of inhale as much as I could. And realized quickly that, the only way to do it was to start at the end and work backwards. Which is, I think, the reason it also took a long time for me to finish the script was just because there's no way to really accumulate a lot of momentum when you know the ending already, I don't think. It always flows a lot more readily when the script has an opportunity to surprise you and the story can mm-hmm. surprise you and acquire its own natural momentum. So this was a congested process and it took a long time and it was tough. And so by the time we were finally done, actually it was my girlfriend who was just like, you can't continue to do this. You've got to send it to Adam. Like you can't, you just can't continue to, write this forever. Just let another human being take a look at it. And, and that turned into a pretty significant, point where, suddenly I wasn't alone. And, Adam and I were able to talk about the things that I still wasn't as sure about in terms of the script. And it was really exciting to have those early conversations about where do we take this? And, his agency UTA, came on to help and they were introducing us to prospective producers. And, it just took a long time to find the proper sort of form
marriage
for it exactly.
Was that a demoralizing process, or where did you always have faith that this was going to see the light of day? It's just such a slog, right? Even when you get attachment or you get some interest and then you're about to sign the dotted line and then something goes away or someone gets fired or what was that like?
Yeah, it was, by the end, it was extremely demoralizing. Adam basically gave up on it and just didn't think it was going to happen and was me and him are really good pals and we have a lot of different ideas that we've discussed together. And it really, it was the catalyst for a creative relationship that's a lot larger than the movie. And so it was okay. I wrote another script where, he has a role in it and we were thinking of potentially doing that if the kid detective just wasn't coming together. By the end it was tough to see it almost happen. It almost happened, it seemed, twice, and then it just didn't quite, it just didn't work. And at that point, Adam was like, let's just chop it into 6 episodes and try and sell it as a series. And I completely understood where he was coming from. Partly because we'd spent this long on it already, the idea of having to generate more content and potentially start something that was going to last, years. It was, it's like, even if we had sold it as a series, sure, that would have been great. But then it's like, oh, I'm still working on The Kid Detective.
That right,
takes
right.
like a decade of my life. But, and then thankfully, finally everything happened in the order that it had to happen in order for this movie to get financed. And financed in such a way that I didn't have to make cuts to the script and I didn't have to really make any kind of compromise as far as the original vision and in terms of the world and scope and everything that we were hoping to achieve. And the people that were pulled into that version of the project, as far as the crew, were just absolutely, absolutely the right people. And so we couldn't feel better about how it turned out, but it was certainly a tough process and one that was, demoralizing.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wow. Well, yeah. I mean, again, kudos to you for going the distance there and for believing in yourself and the project. And so you get financed, you have the money, you have the production and you're in pre-pro. What most intrigued you or what most surprised you about pre-production? I think we always think of the director with the bullhorn on the chair and, going to Crafty. And then we also think about the red carpet and the accolades and whatever, but pre-pro is I think also the first part of real hard, non-glamorous work that maybe people don't truly appreciate. And I'm curious what surprised you about that process making a feature film.
It was funny because we'd been fighting so long and hard, and myself particularly, just waking up every day and being like, what can I do to make sure The Kid Detective gets made? When we finally got it financed, there was a moment of wow, we did it, pop the champagne, this is fantastic. And then right afterwards, there was a moment of, oh shit.
Oh no.
Now I actually have to make this movie. And it occurred to me, instantly that, well, shit, like we just got financed and we're already behind. Like if our plan is to shoot in 3 months, it ended up getting delayed by a month and a half. But originally we were, you know, I think the financing came through at the end of April and we were supposed to be shooting in early July, I think, or mid July.
Of 2019 or 2020?
2019.
Okay. Got it.
2019. And so I woke up the next day. I was like, holy shit, we've got like 12 weeks. We don't have a crew. We don't have a cast. You know, thankfully at that point, we'd already started auditioning because there's so many characters in this movie. We began that process very early, which turned out to just be a huge, huge, huge thing. And I give credit to my producer, Will, for being the one to be like, we should probably get you working with a casting director like in February, which is what we did. Mm. And it gave me the time that was required really just to find like the perfect people for each of these small roles. But still there were a lot of roles that we hadn't cast, that we hadn't found. We didn't have our crew, you know, we didn't have our locations, and I was just instantly overwhelmed by how much now had to actually come together. And so there was this, you know, this sense of panic that creeped in early, which was just like, gosh, like there's so many components to this. And I wasn't really relieved of that until we started shooting. And interestingly, I thought that the shoot was going to be the thing that was going to be stressful, where I was going to be, you know, having a hard time sleeping and my mind would be running races. And in fact, that was the relief, like actually being, you know, on set and having the support of the crew and the cast and having everything in front of me. That was great. Like that was probably the most enjoyable part of this entire process. The prep was much scarier because yeah, just so many things that suddenly had to come together. And this movie is so precise in terms of the world and the tone and the type of performance that we were hoping to coordinate throughout the cast.
That's true. Yeah. It is very, specific in the world and the tone. And that's a good point. I guess I didn't think of that, but I think every actor has to be living in the same world that's in your head, or it's going to feel a little off kilter if someone's making a different choice than what you had kind of planned for. That's fascinating. I'm sure we'll talk more about that when we get to production. But I guess two questions. One, I think everyone says like, or I think a lot of filmmakers say, you know, making a feature film is just like making a short film, but it's just longer, right? Do you ascribe to that, or making short films is what it is, and we've done that. And you learn obviously how to make movies in that way. But was there anything going from making a short to a feature in terms of pre-pro and beginning to shoot that you didn't expect, or that was different, or like you said, more stressful, or was it just the scope of it, or what?
I think it was the scope of it, and also the stakes. Just like the stakes are different. Like, and it had been a long time as well between this feature and my previous short. Most of the time in between was spent making the dirties and writing the script, and so my biggest anxiety was realizing that like it's actually been like years since I've directed something that I was personally invested in, and that was an intimidating thing. Where I was just like, you know, I've spent so much of my time in the world of this movie, you know, as a writer. It's like, you know, am I prepared even? Like, have I kept kind of like, you know, my reflexes sharp when it comes to actually like the process of making a movie? And I just wasn't sure. And then the actual day-to-day sort of reality of it, I agree. I think that it's not so different from making a short film, because really you're just reacting to what you see on the monitor and, you know, how that compares with your, your own ideas or your own anticipation. And, and so that again is, you know, like you're just so in the moment when you're in that circumstance that, you know, it did transport me back to the experience of making my shorts and also, making the dirties as well, where it's like, you know, the stakes are huge, but you're so in the present that they don't overwhelm you the way that they might in, you know, prep.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I guess I'm wondering, you had a bunch of work before this. Did you bring, you know, there's certain people who have like, hey, this is my DP. He's my DP or she's my DP till the day I die. Others are like, oh, well, that person's right for that project and this person's right for this project. Who was your DP? What was that relationship like as you walked on set and you know, and also storyboarded or whatever?
My DP was Mike McLaughlin, and I had been friends with Mike for a while. but not like close friends. Like, you know, he was just someone that I would see a couple times a year and always enjoy running into and catching up with. And it was always, Mike is just such a personality and such an enjoyable guy. But we hadn't worked together before previously. And I'd worked with some other friends who were also just extremely talented in different, you know, positions on different projects. And when it came to this one, I wasn't quite sure what to do. I have a lot of friends who I love working with who are incredibly talented. And really, it was just a question of timing and, you know, conversation. And with Mike, like, we, again, you know, when I started talking with him about this movie, like, we just connected in such a natural way. And everything he was saying was the stuff I was already, you know, concerning myself with in terms of the line between comedy and drama and what that means in terms of formulating an aesthetic and an approach. And so everything he was saying to me was something that I was either already worried about or already had a plan for. And so the conversation was just supernatural. And working with him on this was, yeah, like, again, I just feel so fortunate to have had an ally in him who was just so committed creatively. Like, we had a 26-day shoot, I think, which is pretty good for an indie, but our script was about 126 pages. And yeah, it was long. And some of those days were extremely intense. And Mike was just, you know, just such an inspiration to watch on set because he's sweating buckets and was so ferocious and brought such a indie, you know, spirit to it. Even though it was the largest project that both of us had done, he was just such a grinder. And like, you know, there were times when we had 10 minutes to do like a bunch of stuff that we still needed to do in our day. And like, he would just take the tripod and hop onto the set and just start spraying. And it was an incredible thing to see. And there was nothing we could have really done to plan for it. Like, we had a very precise shot list. We didn't storyboard. I think we may have etched out like a couple sequences that we were particularly concerned about, but we didn't really storyboard. We were just, you know, pretty specific with our shot list when we reviewed that several times. And for me, because I've been working on the project for so long, like, really, it was just kind of him pulling stuff out of me, like, being, you know, like, I saw it a certain way. And then he was kind of, you know, like, translating it into something that was useful for him. And, you know, I would describe kind of the way I wanted to enter this scene, or the distance I wanted to be from this character, or, you know, the way I wanted to pivot. And basically, you know, he was receiving all of this. We were building it into a shot list together. And then the actual reality of our schedule was so ambitious that we worked in order of priority. So whatever was absolutely vital to the functionality of the scene and making a performance work, that was first. And there were a lot of times when we realized, oh, you know what, we're not going to get everything. Just had to kind of come up with alternatives and, you know, figure out a way to tell this story that was going to be satisfying for us and engaging and remain engaging for an audience. And I think the big thing with this as well, which I didn't think about as a writer, which now I'll never be able to forget when I'm writing scripts, is it's all characters speaking over a table. Like almost every scene is just characters on either side of a table, whether it's a desk or a dinner table or a coffee table, like almost the whole movie. And and he was able to anticipate that challenge early and really plant new ideas in my brain for how to keep things interesting and, you know, and help it remain dynamic and not get too boring.
Yeah. 360 dolly track around the tables and you're just doing that's interesting thought. Cause again, like, you can get so, you can maybe lose the forest for the trees when you're writing it. And then all of a sudden your DP is like, hey man, we got to find a way to make this visually interesting. Otherwise it's going to be my dinner with Andre for, the whole time, but no, that's interesting. So, so going from the technical side of it to the sort of more soft science of directing actors, when you have a collaborator and B, someone like, Adam, who has a lot of experience, who has worked in TV and film, and that you just personally were a fan of and liked, you know, as a person and actor, like, how did you approach directing him and collaborating with him on set as an actor?
The actual process of directing him was not really different from any of the short films that I'd done or when I was working on The Dirties and, you know, helping redirect those guys in that too. Like the, you know, it's just keeping your ears open. And if something sounds like, okay, that's of the world, that's of the character, that's going to be funny, or at least it's going to be funny for me, it's like, great, we can move on. And if I was like, you know what, that sounds like it's maybe just a little too self-aware or a little bigger, or we're leaning into the gag too much, and then I worry about, you know, what are we forfeiting in terms of the dramatic reality of the character? Like that's where I'd be like, okay, you know, let's, you know, get another version of this. And one thing that, yeah, I mean, he won't mind me talking about, because it was like the big kind of creative, not, I won't even say like tension. There was no real tension, but, when on our first day of shooting, like the first takes particularly, like, were bigger, they were more comedic than I was, you know, than I was anticipating in terms of just like, and it's also, things also just happen to look larger as well when you're on set.
No, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've heard this character speak in your head for 5 years, right? And so to hear the character speak in real life, regardless of the choice, I'm sure it could be jarring.
Yeah, exactly. And so my first instinct was like, okay, let's tone it down. Let's just like take it down. Let's dial it down a little bit. And he was like, oh, okay. And he was very wary of, you know, of this movie losing its comic, life, I guess. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, I was thinking about the fact that this film gets progressively darker. And in order to earn our ultimate conclusion, I was like, well, it can't be that comic. It has to, you know, we can't forfeit reality here. We don't want to wink at the audience. And, so we had a lot of conversations about that, where he would be concerned that I was maybe toning him down too much. And after the first week of shooting, we just came up with this method where, like, he was going to take the first takes on every lens, just the first one or two takes. And then I would hop in with my kind of more granular notes, and, we would go for those. And, thank goodness we did, because what the film, you know, like our first cut of the film, I was relying on a lot of my more grounded takes. And anyone who's seen the movie will know that this film is quite grounded. Like, you know, it never gets too large. The first cut of it was even more so. It was like even more like subdued, and you know, it took me a while to realize that, like, oh, you know what, like, we need more energy. We need to go back, and we need to like look at like some of those, you know, earlier takes that Adam was doing. And ultimately we just found the balance between those and between what we had, and kind of just found a new, we kind of recut like the movie at a certain point. And that's the point when it sort of started to feel like it was working for us.
That's cool.
Yeah. But that was sort of the story of Adam on set was, I mean, he it was incredible again on a first feature to have an actor who's that committed to the project, who is that much, you know, invested personally, who connects with the role, and who is just a supporter, and, you know, like, who has your back, who, you know, you're not going to have, you know, a hard time with, even if there is just like a difference of perspective. And the difference of perspective that we had turned out to be the film's kind of like saving grace ultimately, because we were able to achieve sort of both aims in terms of making a film that ideally is funny and that ideally also has a dramatic point and, you know, impact.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. I think it's also, even if you happen to fall into it, I think that's a great lesson to take to the next film. And I've heard that from a lot of people, which is, you know, again, you get the vision for what it wants to sound like in your head, and you get five takes that do just that, and then you move on, right? And then, like, I've heard other directors, and I think that this is kind of what you did, actually, you know, it was like, do one, you know, happy, do one angry, do one wry, do one sad, you know, whatever. And then, like, you can literally create a whole new performance in the edit bay, or sort of like tell new, have new subtext in the edit bay that you maybe even didn't intend on the page, right? So I think that's super fascinating that you're able to kind of like, if you wanted to, you could probably have a whole nother cut of this film that's like the Sin City cut versus like the, you know, straight comedy cut, the Ace Ventura cut, say, because of the different takes you got. So I think that, but then you obviously struck the balance. And I mean, I will say again, as a viewer, I think you found the tone perfectly. I love the moment, you know, he plants earlier that he got this lifetime subscription to the free ice cream. And then there's the moment when you flash forward in present day and he's like, you know, one, whatever. And the guy, you can just tell, has had 20 years of being so pissed at this guy for taking advantage of this deal. But it's just, you know, it's just a look. It's just the most subtle look from that actor behind the counter. And I thought it was lovely.
that's great.
Yeah, let's move on here because we're getting close to the end. So I think you kind of naturally led us to the last portion, which is post. Are you the kind of guy who's like, you know, hovering over the editor's shoulder and holding their hand on the mouse and, you know, making the cuts? Or are you a little more hands off, like show me the first cut and I'll give notes? Or how deep in Premiere were you? or Avid?
I was pretty deep in the sense that what I was searching for on set was so specific in terms of delivery. Again, and it's like, you know, as to the previous point, like, you know, I'd love to be able to get like, oh, let's do like the Al Pacino take and let's do like the more reserved take. With this script, you know, because it's so specific, what I was focused on was like, really kind of like particular, like sort of pacing or, you know, joke kind of deliveries, like, and keeping everything on the same frequency and in the same world. And so that was the thing that ultimately prohibited us from getting like all the different colors of the rainbow in terms of like, this one's going to be louder, this one's going to be quieter, this one's going to be funnier, this one's going to be more serious. If we'd had more time, I think, you know, it would have been great. For that reason, because what I was searching for was so specific, you know, but at the beginning of the edit, I was going through all of the footage and basically isolating the takes that I thought were the most useful. And so I was pretty involved in those early days. And once I'd gone through a sequence, I would send my selects over to the editor and then he would have his just uninterrupted shot at like building the sequence. And again, I was so lucky with my editor in terms of just like our natural instinct, our sense of humor, our taste is just so well aligned that, you know, I definitely didn't have to hover. As soon as that sequence was, you know, cut and assembled, and as soon as we had an assembly of the movie, I was there every day just really working it and, you know, continuing to try things and experiment with it. And we did a lot of screening for friends and, you know, fellow filmmakers to get a sense of what was working and what wasn't. And honestly, it was tough with this movie. Our shoot went so well that I kind of believed we would arrive in post and take a look at what we'd done and be like, there it is, you know, like, hooray. And as we were building the movie, we were still really encouraged just because we were so pleased with the performers. We were so pleased with what our team had pulled off for us. And it wasn't really until we had the first assembly and we were screening it for our producers and a friend, that it became apparent that, oh, you know what, this actually isn't really working. Like,
oh wow,
it was a longer script, and without making any adjustments to it in our first assembly, like I think the first cut of this movie was 2 hours and 15 minutes, at least 2 hours wow. and 10 minutes. Now it's 95. So wow. We literally cut a half an hour out of the film.
Yeah, we need the Zack Snyder cut.
That's right. Yeah. And we did so without really losing very many scenes. Like, we did it just by tightening and seeing opportunity and losing lines that I really liked. And that, you know, the script, if you were to compare the film that we arrived at with the script that I wrote, the script was, there were more moments with just the character where like there was like a 3-page scene of him writing an email to this girl that he met and then rewriting it and then rewriting it. And like, it was just like, again, something that when you read a script, it works in a way because it's just more like a novel and you're just identifying with the character. You are the character versus watching a movie and you're watching the character. And it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't cinematic. I should have guessed that it wouldn't be, but I was still very reluctant to lose that type of stuff. Cause I was just like, this is how people are going to identify with like our hero. And it turned out that we didn't need a lot of it just because of Adam and because of the way that he makes a character who is self-interested and selfish and manipulative human and, you know, and kind of charming in a way. And so we were able to tighten a lot of that stuff up and without losing anything, I think, without losing anything that really matters to the appreciation of like the story. But it took a while for us to be able to see that, just because we did like every individual scene. We cut out probably the funniest sequence of the entire movie in terms of like pure audacity. Wow. Yeah. There's, Adam's told the story in some of the stuff, some of the interviews that he's done recently, but, there is a moment in the movie where, he wakes up after a night that we haven't really seen, where he's on a kind of a drug binge. And what used to be there was this completely absurd sequence of him playing. He had a band in this version, in the original cut of the movie. He has a band and he ends up in a city playing a show. And the cousin of the boy who's been murdered, who he meets earlier in the movie, arrives, and she's like, you know, in her 20s with her 20 something friends, and they end up all doing these drugs and having ultimately like a unseen, you know, sexual encounter. And he wakes up in bed the next day and they're trying to rouse him, and he's unresponsive, and they're slapping him and shaking him and he's not waking up, and they actually drag his naked body down a hallway and feed him into a garbage chute. So that's a solid 6 minutes of the movie that was the most like standalone, like, you know, certainly the most absurd and probably the just kind of the funniest sequence of the film that we had to lose. And our process of editing was really just recognizing over time the opportunity to lose things that were not obvious earlier. Because if you'd asked me before, I'd been like, we can't lose that. That's the funniest shit in the film. That's what people are going to talk about. It's like Adam Brody naked getting shoved into a garbage chute. That's the thing that's going to, you know,
it's the poster, like, baby.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so the process of really completing this film was one of recognizing what could be extracted. And, again, I'll give credit to our producer, Will, who, you know, was just, he was able to see it. Like we were so immersed in it, and trying to make everything work instead of taking that one extra step back and being like, you know what, we can tighten this here, we can tighten this there. And it was after we made those hard decisions that all the other, you know, decisions that we'd made and all the wonderful work that Kurt had done in editing this film in terms of just, again, the balance of tone and the comic kind of rhythm and timing of everything, then it, you know, it just flowed. And that was sort of more or less like the process of editing this movie. It was really long. It took us 9 months ultimately to do. You know, there were a lot of really, you know, exciting decisions made along the way in terms of the beat by beat stuff. And again, Kurt's such a talented editor. I just want to work with him for the rest of my life. but we were so in absorbed by it that it really did require someone standing, you know, a meter back to be like, we could still lose 10 minutes here.
And hopefully, you know, I think, and I think that we all just get better at that skill set as well, the more we do, right? Like in theory, again, you have your babies because they're fun to have, and then you have to kill them later, which is not fun. But, you know, in theory, 3-5 films from now, you might be like, oh man, this is such a fun thing on the page. I want more time to devote elsewhere. I'm going to cut this scene. You know, I don't know. Like, I think hopefully you get better at editing on the page than having to do it in the post, in the bay. So, that sounds like a great lesson you learned there. So, let's jump forward. We're almost done here, but let's jump forward to, this is a super unique situation that you are in. You were the first filmmaker I've interviewed that has had a movie come out in the age of COVID. And man, I was so close to it, cause just personal business. I didn't get the screener link till pretty late. And I was so close to just like driving 45 minutes, up the, 405 in LA here to go to some random theater to see the movie at 10:30. But like, there were two other people that had, you know, you could buy the tickets, and there were like two other people already in the theater. And I was like, I'll just wait. And then I got the screener and whatever. So, but as the filmmaker, It's in theaters now. What has that been like?
Yeah, it's obviously, it's an odd time to, you know, have your film released in theaters. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of very reasonable trepidation and, you know, it's reflected in like the numbers and all that stuff. But I don't think our release, I don't think it would have been as wide as it was. Like, we're on 850 screens right now in the US, which is like much, much more than we were ever anticipating.
Interesting.
And so, you know, like there's the trade-off of, you know, now is not the best time, but in another sense, it like, it kind of is the best time for this type of movie where, you know, we're getting more screens than we likely would have and we're competing with less, you know, we don't have like as many, you know, well, the fact that there's not like the studio tentpole out there right now means that maybe there is more awareness and we are getting, you know, reviewed in more cities. And at the end of the day, for an indie, I think all you really hope is that people are going to be aware the movie exists. And so the fact that like we have a theatrical release at all in the US for a Canadian financed film and that it's diffused, like, you know, it's pretty amazing. We're kind of like stunned by how it's unfolded. And also we just finished the movie like a month ago. Like it was only, was only acquired like 5 weeks ago. And so this has ramped up insanely quickly. And it wouldn't be happening, I don't think, if it wasn't for just the crazy, you know, world, that we're inhabiting right now.
So would you say that like in your mind, in the Earth 2 where COVID is not here, do you think that it would have been a different experience getting the film distributed and in theaters?
I think it probably would have, been different. I think that, I can't speak to like Sony and, you know, what motivated them to, you know, acquire the movie, but obviously it's a moment where movie theaters need something to screen, it creates an opportunity for this type of a film. And the fact that the theaters were closing and that there's just so much uncertainty, we went from really just having sold the movie one day to, you know, 2 weeks later being told like we're going to release this in 850 theaters in
amazing
10 days.
That's so cool, man. I mean, what a treat. I mean, again, like I'm speechless. It's amazing. Like you did it, right? And so like just to go on this journey and to work with this person that you were a fan of and then became a friend of and a collaborator of, and to have this film that looks so amazing and you're happy with it. And then despite, or maybe because of this whole insane world that we're living in right now, you have your film, your first film, I'm like your mom, up on the big screen. I mean, that's just, there's nothing else like it. And I would say, maybe you're already thinking about this, this is also, I would say, the only time and the perfect time for you guys to get an Oscar nomination, right? I mean, like, who else are you competing with this year for best drama, all right? Or best picture. I mean, I think this is the time to go for it, right?
I mean, I definitely haven't allowed my mind to wander into that realm. Already this is so exceeded our expectations, just in terms of like the nature of the release. It just doesn't really happen very often for like Canadian indies. It's tough to like penetrate the border. And so the fact that, you know, the movie's being championed by like this huge studio, it's ridiculous. It's crazy. Like seeing the Sony logo in front of our trailer, it's just like,
crazy.
What? Like I was editing this in my, you know, apartment like 5 weeks ago. Really it was that fast. Like the when we approved our final DCP to, you know, it appearing in all these cinemas, it was 5 weeks. And so for me, I'm still thinking about like, should we have done this or should we have changed that? Like I'm still
go back and cut that. Yeah.
Mode.
Yeah. Right.
And,
wow.
And now finally I have to let go, which is great. It's a weird thing because the thing that you're told to expect is you're going to sell your movie and then it's going to gather dust. Like that's the thing you're always worried about, that it's just going to sit on a shelf and like, who knows, you know, what will ultimately happen with it. We've certainly been spared that and instead just like had this incredible, bizarre experience where, you know, we finish it and then 5 weeks later it's there and people are engaging and interacting with it. And for Adam and I, it really is like extremely satisfying to, you know, to finally be at this place with it and be like, wow, we, you know, it's a movie and people are aware that it's a movie and we're proud of the work that we did. And, you know, it's a pretty amazing feeling for sure after the amount of time.
Yeah. And again, I will say, this podcast is about the making of the film. It doesn't matter what the end product is or how good it is, but I will say for myself, I love this film. Everyone out there, if there's a safe way for you to go see it, please go see it in the theater. It's really fun. If you can stream it later, but you should watch it. It's a very good film. So there's my little plug for you.
Thank you.
So let's jump into the last quick fun stuff and then we'll get you out of here, Evan. So I'm going to give you a bunch of quick questions. Answer them off the top of your head as quick as you can. What's your first instinct? And then we'll be done. So what is your favorite movie quote?
Pretty hot in these rhinos from Ace Ventura 2 when nature calls.
Of course. Yep. What's your desert island movie? You can only have one to watch for the rest of
it. It has to be The Truman Show. You ask anyone who went to high school with me, what do you remember about Evan? They'll be like, isn't he that weird kid who like loved The Truman Show weirdly? Like, and I don't really watch it anymore because I burnt the fuse, but it's been such a huge, part of my... I guess sure, this is where this whole conversation began.
Yeah. Which director would you body swap with and inherit his or her filmography and then take it forward? So no one else knows that you're in the skin of this filmmaker, but you get to live out their life going forward and make movies.
I'm tempted to say someone young just so that you can benefit
practically
from,
speaking,
the longevity, but I don't know. I think for me, the Coen brothers are the ones that I just like, I find the most, I guess, consistent for me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they have, so many movies and that like, they just continue to keep, making incredible stuff. Like, and they kind of, because they have each other, I guess I get two bodies, but that's the other thing. I think like having a writing partner is also like a real writing partner is also great too, because it kind of takes the edge off all that stuff we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be nice to meet the Coen brothers.
Sure. That's totally fair. Do you have any pre-shoot rituals? Maybe you're driving a set, any playlists or mantras or anything like that?
No, but maybe one will emerge now that I've done this one. Maybe I'll get superstitious and recreate certain things.
Fair enough. What's your favorite item at craft service? You need to grab a snack.
Oh man. We had really good craft. shoot. I think like they had some good like cookies and muffins and stuff. That's great. My game.
Carbo load. Yeah. It sounds like maybe you already have for one degree, but what's another dream actor that you want to work with in the future on another film?
I'm just going to sound such a Jim Carrey nerd in this podcast. Like, it's
kind of I'm with you, man. I'm the same way.
I'd love to do something for Jim Carrey. That'd be amazing.
Every once in a while I fantasize, like, there's probably like a short list of like five people that like I would interrupt, like you did to Adam Brody, and be like, I'm so, so sorry. I know that you're like kind of more a cerebral painter right now, or like, you're not Ace Ventura anymore, but like, you meant so much to me. Like, I think I've like literally plotted out what I would say if I ever met him, or maybe three or four other people. But yeah, I'm with you.
I did it. And this will actually make me seem like a bit of a loser for everyone listening to the podcast. But I went to a taping of Conan O'Brien that was happening in Toronto. He did like a special in Toronto, and Jim Carrey was the guest. And he came out afterwards to sign autographs for everybody. And I think I was about 17. And I was about like, I don't know, 2 or 3 meters away. And I was just like, this is my chance. And so I was just like, The Truman Show is the greatest movie of all time. And everyone went quiet. And it was unbelievably awkward. And my friend who was with me was absolutely mortified and just sort of staring at the ground. And he just looked up and he's like, oh, thanks, man. So I got the message across. I got,
the gospel of Truman. Yeah, that's great. Wow. That's awesome. And lastly, what's one underrated film everyone should check out? Like, what's a film that like, you want to maybe tell your parents, like, and you're probably never going to see this unless your dorky film son told you, but like, what's a movie that maybe everyone missed that we should watch?
I really love this movie from 2009, Two Lovers with Joaquin Phoenix. I think that movie is amazing. And it was sort of overshadowed by his whole stunt about like, I'm becoming a rapper, and he had the big beard and the big hair. But that movie is just so great. And no one really ever talks about it. It's James Gray. So obviously he's a super, well-respected director, but like that one just never got the love. And I really think it's like, for me, it's one of my favorite movies of the last I guess 11 years.
Wow. Great. Two lovers. All right, Evan, you made it to the end. Thank you so, so much for doing this. It was a true pleasure to get out of my COVID bubble, virtually and talk to someone else. That's not my wife. So, if people want to see The Kid Detective, where can they find it?
It's in theaters. Okay. Now. Yeah. It's in theaters in the US right now. And, Canadian release on November 6th, I think. And, UK, November 20th. All theatrical, VOD, TBD. Not sure when it'll be up, but hopefully within the next little while.
Got it. And then where can people find you online should they wish to do so, or see some of your other work or musings?
A Pretty Funny Story, my short, is available on iTunes, and The Dirties is available probably on Netflix or wherever. It's not so tough to find that one. I just started an Instagram account to promote the movie. I got like 200 followers, I think.
Okay.
And that's Evan Morgan from Goosebumps. That's my handle. I was a child actor in Goosebumps. That's the.
Oh my gosh, Evan, we glossed over your child acting phase. Oh my God, I got to do better pre-pro research. All right, well, thank you so much. I am at Ethan Cushing on all the places. The podcast is at First Feature Pod on Twitter. If you want to get in touch with us on email, we're at myfirstfeaturepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and we will see you next time. Bye.